for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Nearly 22 years after the Navy's tailhook sex scandal, a new report from the Pentagon indicates the military still has a major problem. Sexual assault and misconduct are on the rise. Lawmakers are angry and calling for reform. But victim advocates fear a culture of sexual violence permeates the military and will require even more radical measures to address it. Joining me here in the studio to talk about sexual assault in the military, Susan Burke, an attorney who represents military rape victims, Tom Bowman, who covers the Pentagon for NPR, and military analyst Major General Bill Nash, who served for 3 decades in the U.S. Army. Feel free to call us with your questions and comments, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
I do want our listeners to know that we did invite someone from the Pentagon Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office to be on the program, but the Pentagon declined. A Pentagon spokeswoman said she would give us a statement this morning, but she did not. Tom Bowman, tell us more about the Defense Department study on sexual assault.
Well, there are actually a couple of studies. One report came out that said sexual assault reporting was up 6% over last year to about 3,400 reports. But what was more troubling was this anonymous survey done that showed that 26,000 service members reported unwanted sexual contact, and that's up 30% over 2010. So that was really troubling. And as far as prosecution, as far as those that go to court, 1 in 10 cases end in conviction. Now, the Pentagon, of course, is coming up with more training programs. They're trying to beef up prosecution and investigation of victims' rights advocates and so forth. But President Obama came out, was very upset about it, called Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and said, deal with this issue.
Now, the report, and you just cited unwanted sexual conduct. What does that mean?
Well, it's a wide array. It could be, you know, getting grabbed by someone to rape. So I think it pretty much covers the gamut of sexual assault.
Susan Burke, what was your reaction to the report?
Well, sadly, I thought it reflected an inevitable rise. When you have decades of a system that's not working, yet you resist all efforts to change it, and you continue to convict a small fraction of sexual predators, you are necessarily creating a large embedded population of sexual predators in your ranks. So unless we tackle the systemic problem, the underlying lack of a functional judicial system, and we begin to prosecute and incarcerate more of these sexual predators, you're going to continue to see these numbers rise.
I gather the report was actually mandated by Congress.
That's correct. All of this data collection, which is very helpful in showing the extent of the problem, is not something the military has done voluntarily. It's all been as a result of legislation passed by Congress. This is an issue that's been studied year in and year out. In fact, as far back as the year 2004, members of Congress wrote a letter to the then Secretary Rumsfeld complaining that after 18 reports in 16 years, there was still no substantive change. Here we are almost a decade later looking at the same thing. There has got to be a concerted effort on the part of the nation to step up and protect the brave men and women that serve all of us.
General Nash, did the report surprise you?
Well, it disappointed me. Unfortunately, I've been involved in some of these issues from afar in a consulting role on the civilian side, And I knew the problem was there. It was growing. And I was disturbed for a number of years that it has not been handled with the command urgency that such a serious issue requires.
Why do you think it's growing?
Well, I don't know. I'm too far removed from active service to have a true feel, but my sensing is over the last dozen years or so, the turbulence in the force has, and the difficult operations that the military has faced, has caused a degree of turbulence that a great number of issues, whether it be Abu Ghraib, whether it be Guantanamo issues, or whether it be taking care of the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines that that serve our nation, there's just been a lot of things that mystify me and mystify a lot of other people.
Tom Bowman.
And also, you know, with the 26,000 reported, the increase in 30% over the previous year, is it that people feel more comfortable at least coming forward and saying something happened, but on the other hand, don't want to file, a formal report? So we don't know exactly what is happening here, but Bill raises a good point. 12 years of war, is there something there that is having impact on these assaults?
Susan.
Well, what we see time and time again is that the retaliation is rampant. So when you're trying to struggle for answers as to why there is such substantial underreporting, you're looking at 92% of the people that are raped not reporting. That's a rational response when reporting is, by the military's own statistics, reporting has a 62% chance of subjecting you to serious retaliation and career-ending problems, whereas
career-ending. Why
the retaliation is often it culminates in the victim being pushed out of the military. The retaliation is very rampant and it's very powerful. So whoever comes forward and reports the rape, they're ostracized. They're not a team player. Their performance evaluations are impacted. So to report takes a lot of courage. But yet, if you do so, you look at the reality that they are incarcerating less than 1% of the rapists. So you have a very, very slim chance of your rapist being incarcerated, yet you have a very substantial chance of being retaliated against. It's wholly rational in that circumstance that people are not reporting.
Tom Bowman, General Nash, was talking about the turbulence of the last 12 years. Do we have any comparable statistics for the Korean War, the war in Vietnam, even the Second World War? Were any such figures kept?
Not that I remember. And, of course, we're much more aware now of keeping statistics and studies and so forth that we may not have done in World War II or Korea or Vietnam. Of course, these wars have lasted longer. People run longer deployments, repeated deployments. And who knows if there's something there. But it's something for the military maybe to look into.
General Nash.
Well, first off, we have to understand that with respect to female assaults, the number and the percentage of females in most of the wars you cited were minuscule compared to the numbers of women in the military today. So in World War II, the number of deployed women vis-a-vis the number of size of the armed forces as a total, much, much smaller. And I would probably say there are some horror stories behind those numbers as well. But no, it was not kept track of in the same way it is today.
And Susan or Tom, do we have any clear sense of how many of these victims are men and how many are women?
My understanding is that percentage-wise, it's less men. It's 1% of the men are assaulted, and it's 20% of the women that are assaulted. But when you do the math, that means in absolute numbers, there are more men than women being assaulted, being raped.
More men?
Yes. And the underreporting is even greater because the stigma and being ostracized is even greater. And just anecdotally, I represent hundreds of victims. I would say approximately 1 in 10 of the people that come to me are men. And we have some in our pending lawsuits.
The report comes out just after an Air Force colonel who led a sexual assault prevention program was arrested on charges of sexual assault.
That's right. He was arrested for allegedly attacking a woman and a couple of a kid, two or three times, in a parking lot just outside of Washington.
So what does that tell us, Tom?
Well, maybe it tells you this person wasn't screened properly. You know, it's still being adjudicated, so we don't have a lot of information.
How long had he been in that
position? He was in that job a couple of months, and his job, he wasn't in charge. There's a one-star general that's in charge of the whole program, an Air Force one-star general. His job was basically to be in charge of a group of four or five people that put out educational material, training material on sexual assault prevention.
Susan.
Well, one thing that is very concerning to me in this instance, I mean, the fact that it happened obviously is very concerning, but the military has stepped forward and has asked Arlington County to relinquish jurisdiction and to let them prosecute the matter. Now, here you have a civilian victim who's assaulted in a parking lot. The military has a dismal record on prosecution. Arlington County has a much better track record on being able to effectively prosecute assaults. And yet, even now, as we sit here, the military is asking Arlington County to step aside and let them handle it. We obviously hope Arlington County says no.
I believe they did say no, and they want to prosecute it.
Tom Boatman, he's Pentagon correspondent for NPR. Susan Burke is a Washington, D.C. lawyer representing military rape victims. Major General Bill Nash is U.S. Army retired, now a military analyst. Short break. We'll be right back.
Good afternoon. You're listening to WAMU 88.5 in Washington. I'm Mike Kremitas. More Diane Rehm Show in a moment, followed by Bob Edwards at 3, then Interfaith Voices at 4 o'clock. Currently 62 degrees in northwest Washington under partly cloudy skies and windy. Low tonight, 42 degrees. Monday, sunny with a high of 61. Monday night, clear with a low of 41 degrees.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Wells Fargo, working with the Washington Area Community Investment Fund to provide small business training. Details on this work in the community are at wellsfargo.com/commitment. Wells Fargo. Together, we'll go far.
This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any phone calls.
And in just the last 5 minutes, we have received a 24-page report from the Pentagon responding to our request, which has been made over the last few days. Joining us by phone from New York, Rebecca Havrilla. She's a former Army sergeant and a plaintiff in a lawsuit against the Pentagon. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning.
You tell us why you are part of a lawsuit against the Pentagon.
Yeah, I decided 2 years ago that it was very important to bring more attention to this issue. At the time, there was a lot less in the way of media coverage, and it seemed that a major lawsuit would be a great way to get some attention around this issue, and it was something that I wanted to participate in, both for myself and getting some closure for my own personal situation, and in order to kind of speak out for those that I know are still unable or unwilling to speak for themselves.
Can you tell us what happened to you?
I was deployed in Afghanistan from 2006 to 2007, and I was raped by a coworker slash colleague before I came back to the United States. And I also had to deal with a coworker, a sergeant first class, who was my team leader, who was also extremely sexually harassive and abusive on a daily basis for approximately 6 months. And this was coupled with a very hostile environment in my unit. They were not friendly to me or women, and that was known from the beginning of when I when I went to that unit.
And
so it was a constant battle.
To what extent did you go to superiors to report what was happening to you?
I didn't. There's no way I was going to tell my first sergeant or my commander what was going on. They didn't. You know, my first sergeant had a history of sexual harassment already before I even got to my unit, and my commander made it very clear that he didn't like women and that there was nothing to be reported. And when we're speaking about retaliation previously, it's easier to try and keep your mouth shut and your head down. And I chose to, at that point, get out of the military. That the military was no longer something that I wanted to continue on with. And I did a restricted report right before I got out of the military, but I never did an unrestricted report until a couple years later.
I see. Do you think that there is something about the military culture that somehow encourages sexual assault?
Yes, in a lot of ways, I think there are. You know, it's a very hyper-masculine environment. You know, the group dynamics are favored over individual needs and desires, which, you know, suits the military very well. But when you're all of a sudden no longer a team player, or you isolate yourself and try to target, or the military says you're trying to target a good man with a good career, and you're trying to ruin his reputation with some type of sexual assault or rape charge, then many times that environment turns on you and you become the target for retribution and for harassment even more so. And there's also the components of just when you look at, we talk about women in combat. When you are excluding a gender just because of their gender, that makes for a discriminatory atmosphere from the get-go. So all of these different types of things play into the military culture of what is acceptable, what is not acceptable, and what the military just kind of overlooks in the name of the mission and unit cohesion.
Now, do you have any concern that becoming part of this lawsuit could affect your career going forward, no matter what that career choice is?
I going into it 2 years ago, I gave it some thought, but I didn't really understand exactly how it could affect me. I think it's very important that people do understand what type of media exposure can do to you. It's important to tell your story, but it's also important to understand how it can affect you in the future. I don't regret anything that I've done. In fact, I'd do it again, but there definitely have been some consequences, and they haven't been necessarily bad consequences, but they've definitely given me some pause and some reconsideration for the future.
I want you to know that a spokeswoman for the Pentagon wrote this in an email she sent to us at 10:05. Quote, "The secretary is disturbed by a military culture that continues to have this problem, and he's directed strong actions to ensure accountability and improve leadership in the chain of command to prevent this crime and to prosecute sexual assault offenses when they occur. Victims must have confidence in the system, and offenders must be held to account for engaging in this vile crime. Asking just one question from that quote, Rebecca, do you have confidence in the system?"
Absolutely not. There have been some minor changes and some minor steps forward, but the system still has a long way to go before I would ever consider putting my confidence in it again at any point.
Susan Burke, do you have any thoughts?
I would applaud Rebecca and all the others who were brave enough to step forward. It's their courage in coming forward with their names and their stories that have led us to a point where hopefully change will be possible. I do think that although one doesn't want to become cynical, the reality of what we've heard from the Pentagon, what we've heard from the Secretary of Defense, there has never been a time where anyone stepped forward and says, oh, this is all fine. There's always been the rhetoric of zero tolerance. We're going to do better. At what point, you know, I think 2 decades is a long enough time period to have given them a chance to solve it on their own.
I guess what's remarkable in listening to Rebecca's story is the talk of the commander allowing sex jokes, rape jokes, and he didn't want women in his command. Well, women are about 15% of the military now. That number is going to continue to grow. They will likely be in combat positions, artillery positions, infantry positions in the coming years. And I guess what I find remarkable is I've been covering the military for about 20 years, and I covered the Aberdeen sex scandal back in the late 90s in Maryland, where you had a number of drill sergeants preying on young recruits. And now here we have the Lackland Air Force Base case, where, again, you have drill sergeants preying on young women, raping them and assaulting them. And for this to continue to happen, it's astounding. And what you need, and I'm looking at the Pentagon report that came out yesterday with all these recommendations for training and accountability and so forth, you know, it's a commander has to understand what's going on in his or her command. And to allow something like that to happen, you have to be asleep at the switch. To have dozens of people preying on young women under your nose is unbelievable.
General Nash, are you somewhat concerned that the Pentagon would not have someone here today on this program representing that point of view?
Well, of course. I wish there were somebody here. But I would tell you that they're probably scrambling so hard trying to figure out and to knock out 24 pages of information to send you as the show has already begun. I've had a chance to scan the report, and particularly the letter by Secretary of Defense. And first of all, there's no question in my mind the Commander-in-Chief, President Obama's lack of tolerance for such behavior. And he's made that very clear, and that's good.
How much of an impact will that have?
Well,
Susan,
from my perspective, it's not going to have much impact at all unless you have reform of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. You know, the commander in chief, the president has stepped forward and says, well, he has everyone's back.
Yeah.
Well, on next Friday, his lawyers are coming into court to argue that Rebecca and the others, that their case should be dismissed, that the judicial system should not hear their claims, and that there should be absolutely no judicial oversight over the military. Now, we are a nation that has civilian control over the military. We need to step up. Congress needs to reform the UCMJ so that this dysfunctional system is changed.
The president has made a correct statement. It has to manifest itself now in behavioral changes. The problem I have is that for the last number of years, the military has relied on this special office that we've all talked about that you just got the letter from. And even in his letter of yesterday to the Department of Defense, the Secretary of Defense charges this office to do better, okay, to make it, to shorten it. My problem with all of that is at the same time they argue for the responsibility of the chain of command to maintain good order and discipline, they give it to a non-chain of command staff office to implement changes. And the argument I would make and I would urge Secretary of Defense to consider is the people he needs to squeeze are not staff officers, they're leaders. They're the secretaries of the services, they're the commanders of the divisions, the ships, the fleets, and the wings of our armed forces. Further, I think the UCMJ needs to be looked at, but it needs to reinforce the criminal nature of sexual violence. But at the same time, they've got to come up with a way that a commander who decides to overturn a lawful by jury conviction has a rationale. The two cases of the lieutenant generals that have overturned jury convictions is astounding.
Tom Bowman, do you want to talk about those?
It was very surprising. There was a three-star general in Europe that overturned a sexual assault conviction by the jury of a younger officer. And that's one of the issues that brought everything to the fore here, is that people were stunned by that, and that's where people want to remove the chain of command from these kind of sexual assault cases and have it in a separate prosecutorial area.
So, Rebecca, if indeed you do go into court and the government is arguing against you and your attorney that the case should be dismissed, what would you say to that judge?
Well, you know, this has been a very long process, and, you know, from the beginning it's kind of been one of those things where you hope that some changes are going to be made, but in the back of your mind you're kind of like, oh, this is probably not going to happen for numerous reasons, both, you know, judicial and social. So, you know, I think in sitting in previous arguments, you know, there's an acknowledgement that there needs to be changes made, but it just seems that no one is really willing to step up the plate and make those changes. So, you know, if I could say anything to a judge, I would be, you know, be the one to, you know, buck the standard and make the changes that you know are the ones that need to be changed so that all of these survivors and victims can have the potential at going for the justice that they rightly deserve.
Rebecca Havrilla, former Army sergeant from January 2004 to September 2009. She's a plaintiff in a lawsuit against the Pentagon. She served in Afghanistan. Thank you, Rebecca. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones now. Let's go first to St. Petersburg, Florida. Oh, she's not there anymore. How about to Oklahoma City? Good morning, Jason. You're on the air.
Morning, Diane.
Hi there.
Hi. Thinking about this, some other countries such as Israel have had, you know, women in combat arms role where they're really exposed to, you know, male soldiers in, you know, combat environments for some years. And I wondered if there was someone who could speak on if they are successful, and if so, would it be possible for us to model their program?
Susan.
I'm not familiar with the adjudicatory system in Israel, but I can tell you that the United Kingdom has moved and taken the chain of command out of the adjudicatory process, and they have had no bad results. They have seen an increased level of prosecutions. And what happens, because most sexual predators tend to be repeat predators, the more you incarcerate, you begin to make a serious dent in your predation problem.
Tom, I want to go back for a moment to this overturning of the judicial ruling against these three men. What happens after that? Do these men simply go back to active duty? Do they go back into the ranks? Is their service record wiped clean? What happens?
Well, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not sure exactly what happens to their service record, but they do go back on active duty. I think that's what happened in these cases.
And in fact, Lieutenant Colonel Wilkerson, who is the man that was convicted of rape and sentenced to a year in the brig before General Franklin just overturned the jury verdict, Lieutenant Colonel Wilkerson is not only back in active duty in the Air Force, but they sent him to serve in the hometown of his victim's family.
What I'm trying to understand is, on what grounds did the judge overturn a jury conviction?
It's not a judge. This is the problem. The person that's doing the overturning is just a operational person. It's a general. And so it's a general that had a relationship with the accused, with the defendant who had been convicted. And there was no analytical basis for the overturning. Rather, the general, who had not heard the testimony, who had not sat in the trial, considered a series of letters and pleas from friends and relatives of the of Lieutenant Colonel Wilkerson. He considered a lot of evidence that the judge had excluded from trial as not being credible or permissible in the in a court setting. And the general, acting on his own, without any legal training, considered all of that and overturned it.
Susan Burke, she is a Washington, D.C. lawyer representing military rape victims. Short break. We'll be right back.
Good afternoon. You're listening to WAMU 88.5 in Washington. I'm Mike Kremidis. More Diane Rehm Sunday in a moment, followed by Bob Edwards at 3 o'clock, then Interfaith Voices at 4. Spring is here, a time for renewal and growth. It's also time for WAMU 88.5 to grow the membership file. Tune in to Morning Edition this week and join WAMU during our spring membership campaign. Currently 62 degrees in Northwest Washington under partly cloudy skies, low tonight 42 degrees. If you're planning on taking Metro, give yourself extra time. The Green Line is the only line not single tracking for repairs.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, after months of fierce political debate, Congress tackles immigration reform with a bill focused on high and low-skilled workers. Then at 1, distinguishing fact from fiction, teaching kids to navigate viral emails, Facebook rumors, and bias reporting to become more sophisticated news consumers. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any phone calls.
And just before the break, we were talking about the overturning of three rape cases that the victims had brought forward before a jury and were overturned by members of the military. General Nash, you wanted to make a further comment.
Well, I think this particular case involved a sexual assault, and it was one case that the General Franklin, I believe his name is, that overturned the jury conviction. And within the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the convening authority and the chain of command has a responsibility to review the case and make appropriate approval or disapproval or, in fact, mitigation of certain lessening of certain punishments. The issue is, though, that for a general officer to overturn a court's decision is an extraordinary matter and requires a justification, in my mind, a public justification as to the rationale.
Was there one?
No. He gave no explanation.
The other thing to understand is that as a commander deals with mitigating circumstances, evidence that was not introduced into the trial or was prohibited from introduction by the judge, you are on very thin ice making decisions based on that kind of information. And the issue I brought up earlier about the staff agency versus the command agency, what I would like to see is much more emphasis on command responsibility and command accountability. And this is what Secretary Hagel has talked about, the chain of command must stay in charge. And I agree, or I understand certainly, why people lack the confidence in the chain of command, because their performance in recent times has been abysmal in too many cases. So I think that one of the ways we've got to attack this is we've really got to hold commanders accountable and maybe some adjustments to the Uniform Code of Military Justice that specifically requires accountability and transparent justification for action.
To whom was General Franklin accountable?
No one. He after the public furor over his ruling, he did release a letter basically saying that he just found it unbelievable that Lieutenant Colonel Wilkerson had assaulted this woman because he had a nice wife and family. We need to get the command. We need to get the chain of command out of the legal system. They're not trained for it. They don't have an understanding of the complexities of these issues. As General Franklin's decision shows, they're going on gut level, instinctive, emotional reactions, and they tend to, those have been shown time and time again to tend to favor their friends, their buddies, the men. And so it's not, it just makes no sense, and it's not fair or impartial. The people that serve our nation shouldn't be second-class citizens with access to a lesser system of justice.
I'm going to read an email that contains some images that may be uncomfortable and may not be appropriate for children to hear. So please turn your radio down if that is the case. This one says, my daughter is a victim's advocate with the military. She has told me most of her victims will not go forward because they fear retaliation. She even found one of the men she works with on a daily basis date raped one of her victims. She can say and do nothing about this, as the victim will not come forward. A man reported that his pants were pulled off. He was taped to a chair with duct tape. His hand was taped to his genitals, and he was left in a public area. It was considered a funny prank to the attackers. He won't prosecute either. He just wanted to talk to someone. Something has to be done. Let's go to St. Petersburg, Florida. Good morning, Donna.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I just wanted to touch on a couple of things. I've been listening and my mind has been racing. I'm former active duty military, and I used to live in the barracks as a junior enlisted soldier. The environment in the barracks, it's hyper-masculine and sexually driven and alcohol-fueled environment. And I don't believe that the ordinary commander truly understands what is happening. And I don't always feel that it's their fault, because oftentimes victims do not come forward and report every instance of harassment. With the harassment and with the changes that are happening now, I don't see how the Pentagon insists on that this training that they put us through, because I'm still military, this 1 hour a year or this online training that we go through, I don't see how it's effective, because the ordinary male that is not an offender, because not all males are offenders, they don't understand how an offender works. They can't fathom it. I've had discussions with my superior all the time, and we discuss this because I'm a unit victims advocate, and he doesn't get it. And I try to explain it to him, and I try not to be offensive, because he is my superior, but he doesn't see it. And I thank God that he doesn't see it, because that means he does not have that mentality.
The reality is that sexual predation is a crime that's often committed by people that, to all outward appearances, are good people. They tend often to be charismatic. Their performance in their job tends to be high. And so this is one of the dynamics that causes a lot of problems. If you just let the chain of command use their own gut reactions, you may have a strong soldier, a strong performer, who has victimized a vulnerable and weaker performer. That's often the dynamic you see, whereas the rape victim is perhaps not doing as well career-wise. And so it's those reasons we cannot leave it into the workplace. We have to take it out, because predators do not, it's not easy to figure out that they're predators.
And also getting into the point of command climate. I mean, you, in this day and age, it's 2013, to allow someone, a commander, to allow rape jokes or sex jokes, or to say, I don't want to work with women, it's astounding in this day and age. And that's why you have sergeants and NCOs and junior officers to keep an eye on how things are going in your command, and basically taking people aside and saying, that's inappropriate. I don't want to hear that anymore. You're going to be held responsible and right up the chain.
to her being in Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning.
Good morning. The conversation is really disgusting and sickening. The issue about sexual assault and rape in any terms, along the military. I'm a civilian in Cleveland. We just had a big issue where somebody held somebody against their will for 10 years. So not only the military has got an issue, we have it on the street as a normal, everyday people. Sexual assault and rape, to me, is so, it hurts so bad, whether it's a man, woman, or a child. It just seems like the law should be like a little bit, taken a little bit more serious. I guess I'm wondering, how can we, as a society or as people, what can we do to help the whole concept that this country, we can't deal with around the world, but just here in this country, how can we take the rape and sexual assault to a whole new level?
I think that if everyone could raise their voices to their members of Congress and let them know that our service members deserve fair and impartial justice and that reform of the UCMJ is needed, although clearly it's a social problem and there are some really troubling aspects about being raped in the military that differ a bit from civilian life. You're forced to remain in close contact with your rapist. You're forced to salute your rapist. We had one victim who had to show up every day for a body composition check by her rapist. And so the fact that these rapists are not being incarcerated in the military leads to a lot of problems. So I would encourage all the listeners to speak out.
Susan, tell us about these bigger sexual assault lawsuits that are up against the military.
We have filed a series of lawsuits alleging that the Department of Defense, the Secretaries of Defense, the fact that they've let this dysfunction go on for so long, and they have ignored and flouted direct mandates of Congress to take certain remedial steps, that by doing so, they have violated the constitutional rights of the victims. So we're asking for what's called a Bivens remedy. We're asking that the civil system, the civil judicial system, declare that past conduct unconstitutional.
So you've got, in one case, there are 28 plaintiffs, mostly women, but some men.
That's correct. And then we have, in that case, there are three men, and then we have another case pending with 12 total, two of whom are men. And this is where we have been up against the Department of Defense. They have filed papers, legal briefs, and have been successful so far in arguing, in essence, that rape and sexual assault is an occupational hazard, that it's incident to service, and therefore the civilian courts should not be allowed to hear these claims.
Tom, what do members of Congress want to see happen?
Well, they would like to remove the chain of command from some of these cases and have military professional lawyer prosecutors deal with it. Secretary Hagel said that would weaken the system. He wants to keep it within the chain of command. That's what's going on now. But there are a number of bills up on the Hill that would change the UCMG.
And what do you think, General Nash?
I think that when the armed forces of the United States do not care for and protect and for their soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, that the Susan Burks of the world should, in fact, bring lawsuits against the military. I think the military needs to be held accountable. And I think the fact is, though, that I remain convinced that the chain of command can deal with this. It may require some shock therapy. It may require some ending of some careers. And it may require some turbulence over the next couple of years. But I think the military can address this thing and should address it far more vigorously than they have to date.
Tom.
And we were talking about the report that came out this week from the Pentagon, and they have a number of issues, training issues, beefing up victims' rights and so forth. Let me just read the first one out of here. It says, enhancing commander accountability. It wants the Joint Chiefs and the service secretaries to, quote, develop methods to assess the performance of military commanders in establishing command climates of dignity and respect. Now, in this day and age, you would have to tell a commander, you should have a command climate of dignity and respect. You have to tell someone that. That's the first recommendation.
Susan.
You know, the reality of studying this issue and reading the 20 years of reports and reading the 20 years of recommendations, they do not have the answers on how to fix this. We need civilians to control this. We need Congress to speak.
And you've got Senator Gillibrand, a New York Democrat, who really does want to take away sexual assault cases from the victim's chain of command. How likely do you think that could happen?
We're very hopeful. Whether Senator Gillibrand is going to be introducing legislation on the House side, Congresswoman Spears has already introduced legislation. We believe that a serious look at the UCMJ and fixing it to take the chain of command out of the position is something that is likely to occur as people become more knowledgeable.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning, William. William? No, he's gone. Let's go to Pensacola, Florida. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In light of the recent disturbing report that's come out, one thing that I've been curious about, I've been in the Navy for 7 years, is how big of a problem this is compared to civilian society or the civilian world. In two numbers, really, in conviction rates and in frequency and occurrence rates. And maybe a direct comparison would be college campuses.
Susan.
In terms of the comparison, what we know from the data is that the conviction rate in the military of the reported cases is at best about 7 to 8%. That compares to a civilian rate of roughly 40%.
Now, what about the occurrence in the civilian military college populations?
Well, apparently in the general population, about 0.2% of American women over the age of 12 were victims of sexual assault in 2010. So 0.2% in the civilian population. In the military, 6%.
But the fact of the matter is the military needs to be better than the civilian standard.
But it isn't.
That's exactly right, and that's the crime here.
And the crime may also be how the military sees itself in terms of being its own arbiter. But you believe it can be reformed?
I do.
And you don't.
I don't.
Tom?
I'll continue reporting it.
Yeah. And Susan, how optimistic are you about your cases?
Well, the legal terrain is difficult for us. There are a series of Supreme Court decisions that have given great deference to the military. However, in each of those cases, the underlying conduct had some sort of military purpose or military mission. So what we are arguing is that we don't fall into that category. The military itself has admitted that rape and sexual assault undermine military readiness. They have no military purpose. So we hope to be able to persuade the justices that they should not defer to the military.
So I don't understand here. Will you take your cases into a civilian court or a military court?
They are already pending in civilian courts. We have had two district court, the lowest level in the federal system, two district court judges have dismissed them, saying that the judicial system has to refrain from hearing the cases at the request of the military. We have appealed those dismissals, and we'll be arguing next Friday, May 17th, before the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, asking that they hear the case.
Well, we shall see. Susan Burke, she is a Washington, D.C. lawyer representing military rape victims. Tom Bowman, NPR Pentagon correspondent. Major General Bill Nash, U.S. Army retired military analyst. And to Rebecca Avrilla, a former Army sergeant. Thank you for coming forward. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Casey Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, and Daniel Knight.
The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org.
Hi there, I'm Rebecca Shear, host of WAMU 88.5's Metro Connection, and welcome to Door to Door, our weekly trip around the region. Today we visit Arlington Ridge, Virginia, and the Hawthorne neighborhood of Northwest D.C.
My name is Marion Becton. I live in the Hawthorne neighborhood of Chevy Chase, and I am 59 years old. The Hawthorne neighborhood is located in Chevy Chase, D.C. It is north of downtown, and it's bound by Oregon Avenue, Western Avenue, and the Pinehurst Tributary. When I walk outside of Hawthorne, and I do it regularly since I have a dog, a lot of green space, a lot of children, a lot of mature trees, well-managed homes, a lot of people walking, and of course the proximity to the park, so we get to see the park every day. I think Hawthorne represents a really mixed bag, so all kinds of people live here. There are older retirees here. A lot of new young families have come in the last several years, blue collar, white collar. We have every kind of demographic mix, age, every racial mix, very diverse neighborhood.
Hi, this is Katie Buck, and I am 53, and I live in the Arlington Ridge neighborhood, which is a part of Arlington County in the south end of Arlington County. We are the closest community to Washington, D.C., to our north. To the east of us is Crystal City, and to the west is 395, and to the south is Alexandria, Virginia. The history of Arlington Ridge is very rich. It dates back to the Revolutionary and Civil Wars. Fort Scott Park was a park during the Civil War where the Union built a fort to protect Washington. The architecture is very mixed in Arlington Ridge. We have a number of homes that are nearing 100 years in age that were built.